This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Don Gagne, broadcasting live from the Charles Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit, Michigan. Forty years ago this week, Detroit was an open wound. Fires raged in the home of the automobile and of Motown Records.
They're firing very close. Apparently moving more troops in. I'm looking up now. A truck of troopers coming in.
That's radio news reporter Phil Nye in 1967, filing for the old Keener 13 radio. Then governor of Michigan, George Romney, felt helpless.
There's reasonable doubt that we can suppress the existing looting, arson, and sniping without the assistance of federal troops. Time could be of the essence.
While the word riot was on everyone's lips, for many it was a rebellion, a violent response to years of police brutality, unemployment, unequal schools and housing that fed a feeling of hopelessness. It was a demand for civil rights. President Lyndon B. Johnson disagreed.
There is no American right to loot stores or to burn buildings or to fire rifles from the rooftops. That is crime. And crime must be dealt with forcefully and swiftly and certainly under law.
When the smoke cleared, 43 people were dead, 7,000 arrested, and more than 1,300 buildings lay smoldering. Since those days 40 years ago, Detroit has struggled to break down racial and economic barriers and to move forward from the past. Today, we will hear stories from people who lived through that long, hot summer. We'll hear how it has changed them, and we'll hear about how far Detroit has come and how far it has still to go. And we do want to hear from you. If you were in Detroit or in Newark or in any of the other cities that suffered rioting during what was the summer of love, how did it change you? We're particularly interested if you left those areas. Our number here in Detroit is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Joining me here at the Charles Wright Museum is Ike McKinnon. He was a Detroit police officer at the time of the riots. He's now a professor at the University of Detroit Mercy, and he's the author of the autobiography, Stand Tall. Mr. McKinnon, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I want to call you Chief McKinnon.
Thank you.
Because the thing we did not mention here is that you were the chief of police for the city.
I became chief in 1994, yes.
Under Detroit Mayor Dennis Archer.
Yes.
Let's set the scene as to what happened that night, that early morning, actually, Sunday, July 23rd, 1967. There was a raid on a blind pig. There were these illegal after-hours drinking establishments, bars, all over town.
Yes.
Really then. Yes. And this was one that it was an African-American blind pig and some soldiers just back from Vietnam.
Yes.
We're celebrating their return with friends. It was quite crowded. Police raided the place.
Yes.
And it was more crowded than normal.
Than usual, yes.
Than usual. And they tried to arrest everybody. And they were bringing people out on the street, and it took a long time to get the vehicles in to take people away. And the neighborhood, people started coming out, and things started.
Everybody was out, and at that point, people decided that they would take things into their own hands, and it evolved into the 67 riot.
And literally, just from that evening, it just...
Actually, it was early morning.
I'm sorry, early morning.
Yes.
Saturday into Sunday morning.
Yes.
It built. Now, you were a police officer at the time.
With less than 2 years on the job.
Yes. Just a kid.
This idealistic police officer, yes.
And you were also an anomaly in Detroit. You were a black police officer.
We had very few black police officers in a force of 5,500.
Why so few?
Well, at the time, the recruiting and the history of this department, the police department at that time, there were very few blacks recruited, and certainly women and Latinos and such. We had very few. That was the standard for the department.
And so fewer than 10%, 7% in that range, the figure I've heard.
Yes.
But the city was still majority white.
Yes.
But a very large, substantial
absolutely
African American population.
Yes.
That night, where were you that morning?
I was at home, actually. I was at home in bed, and I received this call from my sergeant, who said, "Ike, we need you. A riot's jumped off." And, of course, being this young person who had gotten this call from my sergeant, I said, "Sarge, you're kidding me," and I hung up the phone.
And did you live nearby?
I lived in the heart of the riot. I lived at 3265 West Boston, the 10th Precinct, where it all jumped off.
Okay.
Less than a few blocks away from where it jumped off.
So after hanging up the phone,
and
then
I,
what?
I it's one of the few times in my life I've been able to go back to sleep after waking up. And I got this call. Sergeant Berryman was his name. He called me back, and he says, "Ike, I'm not kidding." And he didn't say those words, but something...
somewhat more pointed,
yes,
perhaps.
Yes, yes. And he said, "You better get your behind down here right away." And I immediately jumped up, and... I started to wonder what was going on, because in the police academy, we had received all this information, and certainly we had heard of what had occurred in Watts and other places, and I started to prepare myself for what might be occurring, and I looked out the windows to see what was happening, and I was one block east of Dexter, where so many things had jumped off. I jumped in my car, and I drove to my precinct, which was down by the old Tiger Stadium, which is the second precinct.
Okay, and did you have your full... Detroit Police uniform
oh, yeah.
on, your badge in full display?
Yes, full display, yes.
How did you feel wandering into it, besides being, I guess, terrified?
Well, I wasn't terrified. I was confused because I didn't know what was going to happen. And the thing that stood out for me is, number one, what was going to happen? When were the fires going to start? Number two, when would they start shooting? And how many people would get hurt? And those are the things that stood out for me. That first hour of this riot.
Was there a moment early on that you thought, this is it, this is what I feared, this is where it could get really
bad? Well, there's no
bad.
Question. Plus, I had family. My family was here. My parents lived in the heart of this, my brother and sisters, and you know, you're concerned about them also.
We've heard so much about the tensions between the black community and the nearly all-white Detroit police force. There was allegations of brutality, and in the black community, that was how they viewed the police in many cases, right?
That's why I became a police officer. I was severely beaten as a young man. I was 14 years old, severely beaten by the Detroit Police Department by four officers as I was a freshman in high school, by four officers, white officers. And it was something that one couldn't imagine unless you were there. And I made myself a promise in 1957 that I was going to become a police officer, and certainly I was going to be different than those guys were. I made that decision in 1957, and in 1965, I became a police officer.
An unprovoked beating at the hands
unprovoked,
of police?
Unprovoked. No, that was almost the norm for the neighborhood at that time. And it's kind of interesting because so many people, they don't see that, and when you don't see that, you don't believe that. But as a young person growing up in that neighborhood, it was part of, it was a common thing for my neighborhood.
Let's go to our audience. And we have Ray Litt standing
yes,
at
sir.
The microphone here. Where are you from first?
I'm from Detroit. I lived in Detroit 75 years. Went to Detroit schools. I'm chairman of Castech Alumni Association.
Castech High
School. Ike McKinnon is a Castech grad. My basic concern about what I've been hearing over the week is the fact that there hasn't been enough emphasis on hope.
Mm-hmm.
What happened as these things began to evolve, we in the neighborhood, and I lived in Northwest Detroit at that time, realized that we needed to get together and know one another. So we, like other neighborhood associations, formed Schaefer 7-8 Lodge Association, created a newsletter, began to talk to one another. This is an integrated neighborhood. We began to realize that most all of us have the same needs, desires, and wants, and that we can have a better life if we get together.
Was it the violence that started on that day that prompted neighborhoods to do this, or were those things already in place?
I think that it was a catalyst, and we refer to it, as you did earlier, as a rebellion.
Mm-hmm.
And the chief knows the kinds of situations that there was in the city at the time, the stress unit, the kinds of
stress was a special Detroit police
stress,
unit.
Sheila Murphy worked so mm-hmm. hard to get rid of it, who she's now on the council, Sheila Murphy Cockrell.
Mm-hmm.
These things did happen and created a situation where there was more involvement. And furthermore, I believe it was a lead to the effort to desegregate schools.
Mm-hmm.
And had we been successful in that effort, and a lot of people will disagree, including my wife, because we lived a block from the school, Vandenberg, we would have had cross-district busing. And my kids would have gone to a school that was a half mile away from my mother's house in the suburbs.
Let's get Chief McKinnon to comment on what you saw as a police officer, neighborhoods, seeing this as a catalyst to improve relations within their block or within their precinct.
Well, certainly there were a great number of, whether it's block clubs, and if we can go from, as a young boy, what I saw, where there were very few people that were involved in blocks as such. In fact, the police department did very little to get blacks involved. As I got more into the police department, there were some that got involved. As we got older and older, you would see the police department that would occasionally get people involved. But as we got more and more and more minorities on the police department, we get more people involved, be it Nate Conyers or and others, there was this call to get more people involved, as you said, from Sheila and others.
We're in Detroit, Michigan, talking about the 1967 riots with Chief Ike McKinnon. We'll bring in more guests in a moment. We're talking about how the events of that week 40 years ago changed the city and the lives of many of the residents here. When we come back, a former reporter who covered the riots tells us how that experience led her to a whole new career. We'll also get comments from the audience and your calls at 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Don Gagne. It's Talk of the Nation from Detroit from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Don Gagne, broadcasting today from the Charles Wright Museum of African American History in Detroit. It's been 40 years since the long, hot summer of 1967. Nearly 160 cities across the country erupted in violence that year. The largest, right here in Detroit, was driven in large part by racial tensions in the city. But days after the violence subsided, Michigan Governor George Romney played down the influence of racial tension.
I don't believe this is primarily a racial situation here in Detroit. The Negro leadership in the community has been just as anxious as the white leadership to stop what is obviously a very tragic development.
We'll talk more about the frustrations that led to the riots in a moment. Ike McKinnon is with us still. He was a young police officer in Detroit at the time of the violence. Later, he was the chief of police in the city. And we want to hear from those of you in the audience today and on the phone. If you were in Detroit, if you were in Newark, or in any of the other cities that boiled over that summer, how did it change you? The number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. You can email us as well at talk@npr.org. That's talk@npr.org. And please share your stories on the blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. We now go to our next guest. Sandra West is here. Sandra, greetings.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Tell us what your job was in 1967.
In 1967, I was a reporter, and I, as you said about Ike, I was an anomaly. I was the only African-American reporter for United Press International's Detroit Bureau. And therefore, I was, you can say, either in the right place at the right time or in the wrong place at the right time.
So this is a major wire service. This is United Press International. In those days, one of the big ones.
Exactly.
And in a major American city with more than that, million people, a huge African-American population, and you were the only African-American face.
At that point in time, at that bureau, yes.
that night, that early morning, when the violence broke out?
Actually, and this is another coming together of fate or something, I had been working weekends or the overnight shift at UPI. However, this particular weekend, this Sunday morning, I was home. And it was a very hot morning. I don't know if everybody remembers, it was very, very hot, like in the 90s. I got a phone call at home from my boss saying, you got to get out there and see what's going on.
So you got the call like I got.
Like I got, yes. And I'm just a cub reporter. I'm a kid.
So how old were you at this time?
I was 26.
Okay.
I had just gotten my degree in journalism from Wayne State University. Wet behind the ears.
At a fine journalism school then and now,
one
still.
One of the best.
Yeah.
And I got up. My dad went with me. We lived...
So your dad went down with you?
Yes. We also lived in the area. We lived on LaSalle and Claremont, which was two blocks from where it started. So he went with me. We walked down to 12th and Claremont, and the city was on fire. Fire all over, up and down the blocks, from West Grand Boulevard all the way to Claremont. And I don't know how many blocks that is, but that's a long distance.
So that's the flame, the fire.
That's what we saw. And we saw...
What were people doing?
People were breaking windows, breaking shop windows. There were stores all up and down 12th Street at the time, looting, carrying out televisions and all kinds of goods. And there were shoe stores... clothing stores, grocery stores.
And these are white-owned businesses. They're black-owned businesses.
Black and
white. It didn't matter.
Yes. As the
What about the looters, as you described them? White and black at this point?
I don't remember seeing that many white looters, to be honest with you. However, there were black shops, and some of the black shop owners put signs in their windows saying, Soul Brother, to keep the people from looting, as if to say, don't bother me. I'm one of you.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like being in a movie, watching it from outside looking in.
So you're there as a reporter. This is your city. You have to chronicle this. Who did you interview?
Basically, I got a chance to interview the people on the street because they didn't want to talk to white reporters. And as I say, I'm a kid. I'm just wet behind the ears. I'm just talking to people. But I did identify myself as a reporter. And I talked to a lot of young men. There was so much anger that was predominant as to what was going on in those days.
Anger
at the police, anger at the economic situation they were in. No jobs, no hope. It was a hopeless time.
The auto industry was already starting to contract in Detroit at that point. It was shrinking. Plants were closing then.
Yes.
And the skilled trades jobs... black workers couldn't get access to.
Exactly.
Let's go back out to the audience. We have Scott from Ann Arbor here. Hi, Scott.
Hi, thank you. Good to have you back, Don.
Thank you.
I'd like to ask you to compare the other riots that occurred. Like you mentioned Newark. Why was Detroit so intense, so different? That's it.
Chief McKinnon, you want to weigh in on that? I mean, a much larger city than in some of the others we saw.
I think that for us, and I'm speaking specifically from the law enforcement standpoint, Detroit was such a polarized community. And again, I'm speaking from this law enforcement end, I saw people who for the first time had an opportunity with that power and that ability to use that power in such a way, and they took advantage of that. My instance I'll give you is that as a law enforcement officer, I was in uniform, and I was shot at by my fellow officers. And so if they shot at me, who else would they shoot at? So we lost 43 people in the city. We almost lost 44 with me. And if they took advantage of me trying to kill me, who else would they? And
you were caught in the middle.
I was caught in the middle.
You weren't safe with the police officers with whom you were working, and you were a police officer to those in the neighborhood.
Absolutely. And as Sandra said, I'll tell you one little story here. The stores... there was one store, and we got a great chuckle out of this. There was one store that so many stores that had Soul Brother on them, and there was this one store that was, I believe it was Korean, and it had Me Soul Brother 2. I thought it was great, you know.
Sandra, one of the things we want to hear is how these events changed people's lives. Any of us who are around here then. I mean, it's something we carry with us today. It provides the subtext for so many things. You left journalism shortly thereafter.
Well, I left that kind of journalism. What happened was my stories were appearing in newspapers across the country, across the world, actually. And I got a call from, at that time, the mayor was Jerry Kavanaugh.
Mm-hmm.
I got a call from one of his aides. I had taken a test to be a publicist for the city of Detroit sometime prior to going to work at UPI. So my name was on a list to be hired, you know, as attrition took place.
Did you see going to work for the city and initially for the Kavanaugh administration as a way to start the healing, to help Detroit do what it needed to do?
I felt that I wanted to tell Detroit's real story and some of the positive about Detroit. So I didn't want to be a reporter where I had to talk about the negative because, unfortunately, journalism is a lot of negative. I wanted to tell the positive story. So I did indeed go work for the city.
But clearly it was a city with many troubles then.
Yes.
And as evidenced by what happened in July of 67.
Oh, yes. And my going to work for the city was just my little part and my little piece of the puzzle to try to help get the story out about the good part about this, the city of Detroit.
And how long did you stay with the city? How long? Did
I actually stayed for 30 years and retired in 1997.
All right. Wow. Let's go here in the audience. We have Stephen Johnston. Where are you from, Stephen?
I grew up in Northwest Detroit.
Okay.
And I was just wondering if there was any Detroit police officers that were charged with crimes after the riots.
There were certainly investigations.
We had the infamous Algiers Motel situation in which there were three Detroit police officers charged. They were found not guilty, in which I believe there were three young men that were killed at the Algiers Motel. And I believe there were some private guards and maybe some National Guards. That was a horrible situation that occurred, and I think there's some other things that occurred, too.
Let's go to the phones. I think we have here, I'm new to this system, folks, Linda, are you there from San Francisco?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Okay.
You're talking to a room full of people in Detroit.
I'm in my car. I live in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area, and moved away from Detroit after having lived there my whole life. About a year and a half after the riots.
And the riots were the reason? I'm sorry. The riots were the reason for the move?
Well, I think they contributed. There's no doubt in my mind that it was a factor. It was absolutely a factor. It wasn't the precipitating thing, no, but it was definitely a factor. I grew up in Detroit. It was a beautiful city. I graduated from Mumford High School, from the University of Michigan. My mother was a graduate of the University of Michigan. My father graduated from college in Detroit.
Let me ask you, where were you that night?
Okay, I was in my home with my children in Southfield, Michigan, and my husband, and it was on the news, and it was just so hard to believe looking at what was happening. And my immediate reaction was, why are they doing this to themselves? Why are they destroying what's theirs? They're angry, yes. The black population is angry. But what they're doing just seems so futile and so senseless when they're just hurting themselves.
And where was home for you? Where did you live at the time?
I'm having trouble hearing you.
I'm sorry. If I missed it, did you tell us where you lived? In Southfield. Okay, I'm sorry. I missed that part.
Where did you?
Which is just north of Detroit. It sounds like we're getting some breakup on your cell phone, Linda, but thank you for calling. Sandra, do you want to just kind of comment on this, kind of that reaction that people had watching this?
Well, I was there, and I don't know the answers. I don't know. The civil rights movement, so the whole movement with Dr. King and Rosa Parks had started earlier, and I guess a lot of people might have thought, well, by now we should have achieved more than we've got. So all I can say, there was hopelessness. Like, where are we going from here? Now, that also caused the mob mentality to take over.
Let's bring in Carol Boyd. Carol, you lived in Pleasant Ridge, which is a suburb just north of Detroit, just a couple of miles north of 8 Mile. Pleasant Ridge at kind of 10 Mile or thereabouts, right? What was your situation there?
Well, my experience was a bit different than everyone else's, partially because I was 15 at the time. So I was halfway through my summer of love when it got fractured, if you will, by the riots. And what I came quickly to understand was, and in this sense the riots radicalized me, I moved from seeing them as riots to really seeing them as an uprising.
And we should add that you, you're a white woman, you lived in an all-white neighborhood. Pleasant Ridge, I'm sure, was virtually all-white then, if not all-white.
Well, that's true. But I went to Ferndale High School, which was not all-white.
Okay.
That was an integrated high school that my father went to and that my children went to. I continue to live in Pleasant Ridge, but the community Pleasant Ridge did react somewhat differently. We had an idealized version of what Detroit was. That was that it was an integrated city that worked. We went into the city to work, and we came home to the suburbs.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Continue. You lived in this suburb. You said that it radicalized you.
Well, as I started to say, you know, I was a 15-year-old who was self-centered but had grown up in what would be characterized as a liberal family in a suburb just north of Detroit. And the day of what has been called the Detroit riots, I was at a summer home, and my family came home that day, partially to be witness to what was going on. My memory is of laying on the lawn in my yard and watching the helicopters go overhead and worrying about what was going to happen to my city, a city that I spent a lot of time in.
And we should also tell people that today you work at the University of Michigan.
Yes.
What's your job there?
I'm the director of the Institute for Research on Women and Gender and a professor of women's studies and nursing.
My suspicion is that your reaction to this, you said it, you really felt for your city and you wanted to do more for your city, Detroit. That wasn't necessarily shared by the people who lived in the northern suburbs in your area, perhaps that you knew.
Well, I think that's true. I think that they viewed it as a riot. It was characterized often as a race riot, which I wouldn't share that characterization. And they felt that, somewhat like the caller who just called in, that it was people in Detroit doing this to themselves, failing to see it as a situation where 25% of African-American men at that time were unemployed, and that there had already been I wouldn't say white flight, I'd call it middle-class flight from Detroit, but white flight sounds better somehow, or mm-hmm. sounds perkier. And
but people who could pack up and move
left
did.
They're still leaving Detroit, though.
Mm-hmm.
The middle class is moving out to Southfield and the other communities.
And I guess I'd like you to talk about how this experience kind of changed you over time. And did it lead to, in some ways, what you're doing today?
Surely. It radicalized me. I started out as a 15-year-old concerned about boyfriends and rock and roll music, and I graduated from high school concerned about Detroit and racial justice, social justice, and went on to become a feminist and the director of an institute that looks at feminism and the research related to gender.
So when you look at Detroit today, I mean, clearly if we look downtown, if we look at this beautiful museum here, there are some really great things happening, but there are still troubles. I mean, what's your sense of this city, where it's at today, and how far it's come?
Well, I've heard it described as more like a third world country, and or a city in a third world, and that distresses me. But I have to say, I think there's some truth to that. My children, like me, when I was 15, still travel. Throughout Detroit, we use the bus system, they use the bus system, but it's not easy. It doesn't run on time, and they're late to their jobs.
When we come back, we'll talk more about how the violence of 1967 in the city of Detroit changed the Motor City and how far the city has come since. I'm Don Gagne. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Right now, we're wrapping up our conversation about Detroit and the violence that hit the city in the summer of 1967, how it changed the city and the people who live here. Our guests in this hour are Ike McKinnon. He's an associate professor of education at the University of Detroit Mercy. He was a police officer in 1967. He was also once the chief of police of the city of Detroit. Also with us is Sandra West. She covered the riots as a reporter for United Press International and later went to work for the city of Detroit. And Carol Boyd is a lifelong resident of the Detroit area. She lives in nearby Pleasant Ridge. If you were in Detroit, or maybe you were in Newark, or any of those other cities that suffered rioting during the Summer of Love, how did it change you? We're particularly interested to hear if perhaps it caused you to leave a city, and why, and how that has changed your life since. Our number here in Detroit is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can also comment on our blog. It's at npr.org/blogofthenation. Nathan Conyers has been sitting patiently for the last 40 minutes over there. He worked as a successful attorney in Detroit for a number of years, but couldn't resist the desire to become an entrepreneur. He went on to own Detroit's first African-American-owned car dealership, and the oldest African-American-owned dealership in the United States. He's joining us today at the museum. Mr. Conyers, welcome.
Don, thank you very much. Great to be here.
You're a lifelong Detroiter.
Born in Detroit and still live here.
Your experience, your hand for that. Your experience in July of 1967.
Well, for those who weren't alive at the time or too small to remember, you know, the environment in Detroit was quite different from other cities that experienced some rioting. One of the reasons was that growing African-American population in the city. It was beginning to have numbers greater than any other major metropolitan area, and that created an issue for the majority community, the whites, of how to deal with this burgeoning black population. And it had to deal with how they looked at and understood what racism and institutional racism was all about. White flight, correctly stated, did start 15 years before the riot in the city of Detroit. And it began moving as the population of the black community kept moving up. It became uncomfortable for more and more whites to reside in that city. They were permitted to move into all white suburban areas. Blacks who may have had some issues and would like to move were prevented through racism and discrimination from moving into those white areas. You begin to use that as a base, and you begin to look at some of the infrastructure of the city, the police department, as Ike is so... Can you imagine if a policeman has to worry about being shot? If a guy is beaten by a police department and later becomes its chief of police, can you imagine what happens to the 16-year-old black kid who was walking down the street, and there is a unit called the Big Four? There's a process called stop and frisk. There's a harassment of blacks in their own community. There is literal police brutality.
Just quickly, the Big Four. Where did that name come from?
It came from four big white guys
there
in
it
a
is.
Car.
And this was 1967 and before.
And before. And it was, and as jobs began to get fewer, and as urban renewal was setting in, for those of you who remember, large areas of the black community was being wiped out for expressways so that white folks could get from Detroit to the suburbs a little easier. And what happened was that we broke down the whole core of black infrastructure. There were black businesses in Detroit at the time. There were people, our best and brightest kids at that time went to factories and then went to federal government service. Boy, I'm going to work in the post office. And then as time went on, the corporations attracted our best and brightest. Entrepreneurs did not begin to show up in any kind of number until Earl Graves' Black Enterprise magazine started listing them in 1973. Change, differences. In 1973, when Earl Graves published his first list of the 100 top black businesses in America, the top guy had sales of less than $15 million. This year, the 100th person had sales of $15 million. A huge change had occurred as a result of things that went on. The riot precipitated everybody to have a look at what was going on in Detroit. And a lot of good things came out of it. As a matter of fact, that whole concept of New Detroit, in which for the first time, business leaders, government leaders, nonprofit people, and community leaders all came together in the same room to sit down and talk about problems.
And we had to go through, you think? Do you think we had to, what we
absolutely
went through on that
essential
day for these sorts of things to happen?
It's out of crises that progress can begin. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But there were people who had something to do. During the riot, Brother John, Congressman John Conyers.
Just again, Nathan Conyers' brother is John Conyers.
My older brother. I have the white hair, but he's the older guy. John has been in the Congress of the United States for over 40 years. He is the second senior member of the United States House of Representatives. And during the riot, when that fateful evening occurred, and we lived right not far from it, and the first business we took was at 14th and the Boulevard, which is like a mile and a half from the epicenter of the riot. A guy named John Dotson, who was a writer for the Newsweek magazine in Detroit, brought his family over to my house and said, "Keep my people safe. I'm going out on the street." And as Sandra was talking about, there was a lot of activity and a lot of violence going on the street that night.
Yeah, let me stop you right there. Let's take a call from Marcellus. Marcellus is in Boise, Idaho. Are you there?
Yes.
Tell us your story. You were here then?
I was 14 years old, and I was delivering the Detroit Free Press when I knew or saw the riot start with my dad and actually my older brother, who's a year older than I was.
So you were delivering the big Sunday paper that day.
That's exactly right. And so we were delivering the paper and actually coming end of our paper route, and we were coming home, and we saw people that had broken in stores actually walking through our yard trying to get to another place with clothes in their arms and items that they had taken. And at the time, at 14, I really didn't understand exactly what was going on. And like many people in Detroit, although there were people that looted and set things on fire, my parents were of the mind that you just should not be involved in this sort of thing. But as time has gone by, and as I've looked at and heard things, everything from actually I attended the University of Michigan and was there when they had the first black action movement called BAM. Mm-hmm. And I was in a class at one of the universities, one of the schools, and one of the professors stood up and said, by admitting blacks to the University of Michigan, that you automatically lower the standards of this institution.
Marcellus, let me jump in and ask you how it changed you.
Well, it changed me. It made me look at the world and the world I lived in much more differently. At 14, although the community I grew up in, I was poor from anybody's standards. We just didn't have a lot of money, and we were trying to just, make it to that next step or to, become of the part of that American dream. I didn't realize how, in a sense, deprived or many things that we did not have that were available to people and people expected that we just didn't have when I was growing up. There were wonderful teachers and there were wonderful people in our communities that were certainly champions and were role models for us, but other things were there present for us to see too. And I just didn't realize what a huge difference it was from where I was and from what ended up happening when I finally had the opportunity to go to college. And I would mention that I went to a high school, a Detroit high school, and my counselor, when I went to see him for advising, and I wish I could go back and see him and talk to him and tell him this story, but my counselor, who was white, said, you would make a terrific foreman at Ford Motor Company. Hmm. Not that Ford Motor Company would be a bad place to work for, but I had other gifts and other talents to which I think he just either didn't care to see or didn't care to know about. But he advised me to start out or to look for a job working at Ford's. And Ford's is a terrific place to work.
Yeah. But that was the only expectation he would have for
you. That was the expectation for me. And since then, I have gone on. I actually teach. I'm a college professor now.
That's Marcellus, listen, thanks for calling from Boise, Idaho. We appreciate it. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to our audience microphone here. Linda McLean, is that you?
Hi, Linda McLean.
McLean, mm-hmm. Where are you from?
I'm currently from Northville, Michigan. I grew up in Detroit, went to high school there, all of my school years there, Cass Tech, class of 66. And my junior high was integrated, my high school was integrated, my church was integrated. So when I experienced the riots or learned of them Sunday morning when we woke up, it was shocking. It was an awakening for me. I was 18 years old. I was a college student. And I just wanted to comment that there were things that my family wanted to do and others wanted to do to make things better and to help. So my mother and I packed sandwiches and beverages and snacks and drove them over to Six Mile and Grand River, which was all the way across town on the other side. We stood in line for 3 hours to donate blood, and by the time we got up there, our blood sugar was so low we couldn't, we weren't accepted. So we really tried our best to, keep the faith and do something that would make a difference. And my mom remained in the city for another 20 years. I, finished my college education, and I went back and taught in the city for 15 years as well. So,
all right, thanks for that story.
Thank you.
I want to hear from each of you just as we wrap up an hour that's going by way too fast. Mr. Conyers, that automobile dealership we talked about earlier, I mean, the first African-American-owned dealership in the city?
No.
Not the first?
Close, but...
Okay. Thank you for correcting the record then. Tell us about how that came about. And it speaks to... the effort to get more black entrepreneurs.
After the riot and after the smoke settled, people started looking around and said, how can we prevent this from happening again? And that was the creation of New Detroit. There are two people whose names are very familiar to you that played a heroic role in trying to pull the city back together. One was Joe Hudson.
Hudson's Department Stores.
Who was regaled for closing the store in Detroit, but was a central figure in pulling together all of the elements necessary. The other person who did an even more heroic job was Henry Ford II. Henry Ford II actually got in his car and went down on Linwood to the Church of the Black Madonna and sat and talked with Reverend Albert Clegg to talk about
the healing process and what needed to be done. And there were discussions in both of those arenas that said, you must open the economic doors to African Americans. Now, whether you want to call it a riot, a rebellion, a civil unrest, is begging the issue. The issue is that there was in the city a disparity that had to be dealt with. And Henry Ford was the leader in bringing together groups of business people and forcing them to sit down at a table that they had never sat at before. And as a result of that, automobile dealership opportunities started to appear.
The hour is slipping away. Sandra West, what's Detroit still need to do?
I believe Detroit is on the right path, actually, and I would like to commend everyone who's given it a hand at this point in time, politicians, people in industry. There are a lot of folks who are looking out for Detroit now. There's a lot still to be done, but if we can bring more middle class back to the city,
and we need better schools for that.
Better schools, that's the start.
Ike McKinnon?
Really have to think about hope and not give up and step away from the polarization that we have.
It's very real still.
Yes, very, very much so.
Are there institutions in place to do that, or is there still breakthroughs?
This is one of those. I mean, just talking, you know, having this kind of a forum, but just step away from this. I mean, we have these feelings about people that we should just sit down and talk about it sometime.
I want to thank you all for joining us here this afternoon. We're out of time for the hour, unfortunately. Ike McKinnon is here, former Detroit police chief. Sandra West, one-time reporter for UPI, then went on to work for the city. Carol Boyd, who is the director of the University of Michigan Institute for Research into Women and Gender. And Nathan Conyers, who was the president of Jaguar of Novi today. We also want to thank Steve Schramm, Steve Kropinski, Kevin Petrowski, Alan Mazurek, and the entire staff of Michigan Radio and member station WDET. Also thanks to Darren Matthews, Dean Hamm, Leon Lemons, and the entire staff here at the Charles Rutt Museum of African American History. There's more. Talk of the Nation's technical director is Kimberly Jones. Our audio engineer, Stu Rushfield. Today's broadcast was Ashley Grayshaw, Gwen Uten, and Barry Hardiman. There's more. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Don Gagne in Detroit.